McLean. Dick Coach's Corner.
You're listening to the Rugby Coach's Corner podcast with your host, Andy Plymer.
For someone to explain.
Bringing you up-to-date coaching concepts from the world of rugby. Sharing ideas to make the game better.
Okay, welcome to episode number 46 of the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast. I'm your host, Andy Plymer, and joining me today is David Vessels. David is the head coach of the Western Force, who finished second in the Australian Conference of this year's Super Rugby competition. He started coaching under nines as soon as he left school and worked his way up from there. He won the Varsity Cup in South Africa with the University of Cape Town, coached with Jake White in his first year at the Brumbies, and then joined the Western Force in 2013 as a defence coach before being promoted to senior assistant coach and then head coach for the 2017 season. It's a pleasure to have him on the show, so welcome, David.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I have to say, as you know, I've turned you down a couple of times because I feel quite self-conscious about sort of sharing some of my thoughts, but I guess the other side of that is I enjoy your podcast so much that I think it would be a bit selfish for me at least not to add to the conversation a little bit, you know. So I hope everybody takes what I have to say with a bit of a pinch of salt, but you're welcome to delete as much of it as you need.
I don't think I'll do much of that, but I appreciate that, and I think in cricketing terms, you've put some runs on the board this year with the performance that the Force put in. So I'm sure there'll be a lot for listeners to get out of it. And really appreciate the positive comments. So, we touched on your coaching there. What was a bit of a description of you as your playing career and then going into coaching career?
My playing career was a pretty short one. I realized pretty early on that I was never going to be a professional rugby player. I was pretty terrible actually as a player. I played for the third team at school.
Oh yeah.
And they nicknamed us the Icebreakers because we were so bad. We used to go out early in the morning and clear the frost off the fields for the main guys to come later. You know?
Awesome. Yeah.
And to be honest, I didn't even go to a very good rugby school. So we used to play some of the big Afrikaans schools, and sort of by halftime you were sort of wondering when it was your turn to bat. You know. So I quickly realized that I was never going to make it as a player. But I guess there's just something special that draws us into rugby. I think it's one of those games where – one of the few games I can think of where you actually have to put yourself in harm's way for your mates, Mm. And it makes it pretty special, and it makes the idea of sort of mateship and teamsmanship in rugby pretty special and unique. And I guess I just wanted to stay involved in that even though I knew it wasn't going to be through playing. So I took to coaching pretty early, as I say, first year out of school. I started coaching under nines, probably, I think under nine B's or C's at that time. It was probably more like herding cats than coaching at the time.
Totally.
But
yeah.
I just really enjoyed it, and I got to meet some fantastic people, and been incredibly lucky with the people that I met sort of along the way who've kind of given me a leg up. And I think if someone had told me, 15, 20 years ago that I'd be a head coach of a Super Rugby team, I that would just be an absolute dream come true. I just would never have believed that. So really am living the dream and enjoying it very much.
Oh, it's great. And it's definitely, you can see it from the way, when the camera turns to you in the coaching box and the way the team performs, it's obvious that you and the players have just really, really enjoyed the 2017 season.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. I mean, it's obviously, it hasn't been without its challenges, as the AOU have put some pressure on us. They've talked about reducing the number of Australian teams from 5 to 4. And one of the teams that's in the firing line is us.
Mm.
And I guess while that's had some pretty obvious challenges, and certainly the uncertainty hasn't been great, I think what it has done is it's definitely galvanized the group, and it's not only the players, but just the wider community of Western Australia to get in behind the team, all of our stakeholders. If there's one thing West Australians don't like being told is that they can't do something, or that something's going to be taken away from them. From that perspective, it's been a real positive thing. I think the players have really played for the community, which has been the best part, and it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, and that probably leads me to my next question. Like, I always find like teams like that who are a little bit isolated, a little bit swimming up current compared to you know, everyone else. There's something special there. There's some kind of draw. What's the draw for you to the Western Force and that the Western Australian kind of rugby community?
Well, I think the whole community of West Australia is pretty unique. You know, a huge percentage of West Australians don't originally come from West Australia. Either they or their parents have moved from abroad. Many of them from the East Coast, but many of them from other parts of the world. And so, underlying the whole whole society here is a real pioneering spirit. You know, when you think about that, for somebody to leave their home and the people that they know to come to West Australia to try to make a better life for themselves or their family, it takes a lot of bravery, that, you know. And those people inherently are brave. They're prepared to take risks. They're prepared to learn from their mistakes. There's a whole number of things that a pioneering culture has that I just felt we needed to show in our rugby, you know. And I guess what's attracted me to West Australia and the Force is that this whole undertone of everything we do here is about trying a few things, you know, maybe not having all the resources of some of the other more traditional teams, but having the personalities that want to get better and the culture that wants to work hard, you know, which is very rewarding.
Yeah, and like you comment there on the transient nature of the people that come into WA. There's, like, obviously fairly close to South Africa. You're from South Africa. You've had a bunch of coaches come through the Force who are South African and players who have their heritage there. How important is that South African connection to the Western Force, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think we've had a number of good, as you mentioned, a number of good players that have come through here in the last couple of years, which have certainly been a rich part of the Force culture. But it's not only South African, to be honest. Mm-hmm. We had a discussion as a team earlier on in the preseason, the beginning of last season, and there are a huge number of people from all over the world. We've got people from the US, we've got people from Poland, obviously from the Pacific Islands, Indonesia, and so it's this real melting pot of ideas and personalities, and I think all of that is just very rewarding if you're prepared to embrace it and you're prepared to use it to build an identity as a group. You know, the wonderful thing is because we have so many players that are not originally from WA. There's also a real sense of family and community, because the players who come here, often the only people they really know in the state are the other people in the team. And so there's a real sense of community when the guys are away from the field. You know, they might go to the beach or whatever they're doing, but they're doing that as a team. And I think that's a real advantage that we have over some of the teams that are in bigger cities, where you know, straight off to training, everybody kind of disperses and you don't see each other. We've got this sort of natural draw card, which is great.
Yeah, that's cool. And I think I don't want to dismiss also the homegrown you know, element there. I think one of the things that jumped out at me watching the Force this year, and the commentators regularly pulled it out, was you know, there's such a large percentage of the match day 23 are actually, where, no matter where they're from originally, but they came through the rugby pathways that are Western Australia, in a, you know, a Aussie rules stronghold. You know, how'd that kind of player pathway in a development perspective look, and also, you know, with the NRC, which I believe you had a big role in coaching. How important was that in the process?
Yeah, I think there's 12 players in our squad that have come through. We're at school in WA, or have come through the system here. And if you think about it, you know, Super Rugby in WA is only 12 years old. We've only been in the competition for 12 years. Mm-hmm. And those players who are now sort of 20 years old, 21 years old, were maybe 8 or 9 kind of at the time that the Force came into being, you know. So we're seeing the first wave of all of the effort that went into developing those young players start to come through now. And I guess that's one of the real tragedies about us potentially being on the chopping block for our Super Rugby future, is that we're just starting to bear the fruits of you know, all of that labor that's taken a long time, but is certainly coming through now in a very meaningful way. And we've now got a number of guys through into the Wallaby group that are Dane Hallett-Petty, Richard Hardwick, both of whom are products of WA, and you know, Dane's brother Ross, I think, is pretty close there too. Yeah. Jermaine Ainsley, our tight head, is although he grew up in New Zealand, his mother lives here now and came through the club system here. You know, so there's a number of players that certainly are starting to make their mark on the test stage that have come through our local pathways, which is very very encouraging.
Yeah, and I think Lowrens would have been right in the mix if he didn't get injured as well.
That's right. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, awesome. I totally agree. Like that kind of player, like that's a lot of my coaching has been in that player development kind of space, and it's just a slow process. It's a real slow build, and you don't get results overnight. And as the Force is an example, it took over a decade to start getting some international class players, and I think it'd be a travesty to see that be turned away.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the things, you know, bringing those guys through also just builds our connection with the community, and they really identify that, you know, they know those guys well, and we talk a fair bit as a team. You know, I don't know if you know this, but we receive or have over time received substantially less in Wallaby top ups than some of the more established teams, say for example like the Reds and Waratahs, to the tune of a few million dollars, and what that means is that we need to run a better program here. We need to resource our program and basically work harder than some of those other teams in order to be successful. But we often talk about the rewards of being successful, and when we started in preseason last year, the Chicago Cubs had just won the World Series, and they hadn't won the World Series, I think, for whatever it was, 70 years or something.
Yeah,
yeah. You knew that the Chicago Cubs had won the World Series. But nobody could really tell me who won the World Series in the year before the Chicago Cubs, and the point is that nobody expected the Chicago Cubs to win, and they were such underdogs that when they won, the people that came to celebrate that actually was the largest gathering in human history.
Wow!
And so people really supported. You know, people when the underdog wins, the rewards for that just feel, so much greater than if you win with all the resources and ultimately you're expected to win. And I think that's ultimately what probably draws us all to the Force, is that we know it's a challenge, but I think, you know, if we can meet that challenge, I think the rewards for that and just how we will feel about that will be a real once in a lifetime thing, you know. And I think that's what motivates us.
Yeah, no, I think just looking at the style of play this year compared to previous years, you can see that's what you guys are going for. Like it was, I'm kind of a bit of a neutral in terms of super teams. I probably lean towards the Brumbies just because of that late 90s, early 2000 era. But this year, the Force were the team that I would watch that game first before I'd watch any other game, and it was because of the style of play that you guys were playing. Was that like a big thing for you coming in your first year in charge, that you really wanted to change how people see the Force and how they attack?
Yeah, well, thanks for saying that, Andy. I mean, I think to be honest, I'm certainly pleased with some of the progress that we've made, but I think, you know, I have no ambition to finish where we ultimately finished up. You know, our ultimate goal is to try to win Super Rugby, and we didn't achieve that. You know, and I think while we can be pleased with some of the progress we've made, I think we're very realistic about the fact that we've got a huge amount of work still to do, you know. But one of the things that we did want out of our game was that we wanted our game to, as I say, you know, reflect the pioneering spirit of West Australians. We wanted people who were coming to the games or watching us on TV to say, yep, that's my team, you know, and I know that they're playing in a way that's ultimately trying to make me proud, you know. And I think that style, to me, is a little bit more about taking risks, about being prepared to be bumped on your ass every now and then, you know, to make a few mistakes and learn from those mistakes. And so while, you know, certainly, as I say, what we try to do this year wasn't perfect, that's really what we try to do. We try to take a few more risks. We knew that it wasn't always going to work out. You know, we didn't waste too much time feeling sorry for ourselves about that. We just sort of try to learn from that and move on, you know. And as I say, we feel pleased with some of the progress that we've made, but we do know that there's a huge amount of progress still to be made.
Yeah, and I think just going on that, I think in your opening interview you mentioned like a couple of the core things that you thought needed improving was the individual player skills, and then the player's fitness as well, and that you wanted to create training environments that best reflected the game. What were some of the methods that you put in place this year and are going to roll on to next year as well to achieve that?
We did a couple of things. The first one, Andy, is that we spent a lot of time trying to make sure that we get the right people on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Collins wrote a great book called Good to Great.
Yeah,
and he
awesome.
Talks about people on the bus. And so that I think applies to both players and staff. The underlying thing that we try to look for in both of those groups is just people who want to win. And within that, there are different sort of archetypes. You know, you're going to get some guys who are the jokers or the magicians. You're going to get some guys who are the leaders, some guys who are the followers. So there's going to be different personality types within that. But the underlying characteristic of everyone must be a desire to really want to win. When we thought specifically about our staff, I wanted to find, when we put the staff together, I wanted to find a real balance of personalities. I'm obviously a younger head coach. I'm 34. And so our forwards coach, Joe Barricata, is older. He's 54, although he looks about 25. But he's a bit older, and he's a salty sea dog. And I say that with respect. I think he really drives a very good standard with the forwards, and is very black and white about what he expects, and that complements some of my shortcomings really well. And then our attack coach, Sean Byrne, who was with Leinster, obviously played a lot in Europe, but is again a very different personality to both Joe and I. You know, so in that coaching group, we found that purposely try to find, as I say, you know, personalities that kind of complement each other. And then we've got our skills coach, Kevin Foote. And to my mind, I think that's the first time the force have ever had a dedicated skills coach, and he's been fantastic. He just brings a lot of energy to that position, and I think it was also a real sign to the players that we were taking our skill development seriously when we appointed a person full time to help them develop. And then what we did in the preseason around our fitness and our skills is that we try to individualize the programs for the players, so we didn't treat them all the same. And if you think about it, the easiest way to sort of think about how we did it was, if you think about four quadrants, one where, say a first year player comes in, he's new to athletic development, so he has very little athletic base, and he's a very low skill level compared to where he might need to be a top super rugby player. So he falls into one quadrant where, you know, he's low on both those elements. And then on the other side, you might have a player like Dane Hallett-Petty, who's a Wallaby, who's high on skill level. He's also high on athletic development. Those two players need to be treated differently.
Mm-hmm.
And within that, there's two other subcategories. Obviously, somebody who might be high on skill but low on athletic development, or low on skill but high on athletic development. So he might be a very good athlete, but have poor skill or decision making ability. So we basically divided the players into those four groups, and the day would run basically with them flip-flopping through activities that were tailor-made to where we thought their level was. So we might be doing some breakdown work on that day, but the breakdown work for the younger sort of first-year players would probably look a little bit different to the breakdown work that we were doing for the older, more senior players. Mm. We were starting to make it a lot more challenging for the older guys. And I think what that did is it obviously allowed, I think, probably a bit of a safe learning space for some of the guys. They were learning with guys that were at their own level and still being pushed, obviously, by the coaches and different things, because there were still elements of teamwork that we were doing in the week. But it also gave them, we increased the sort of coach to player ratio. So we had, you know, instead of 40 players going into the gym all at once, we were essentially sending 10 at a time.
Yeah.
And so we have two S&C coaches in there with them. So they had real specific training. They had someone basically with them all the time, making sure that we were getting our best bang for buck in the time that they were there, you know. And I think that had a big effect just on as I say, on our fitness and on our skill levels. But we still have a lot of room to grow there. And I think one of the things that we're grappling with, like a lot of other coaches, is just how much do we push the boat out in terms of allowing the players to lead that learning environment versus how much do we sort of guide them, you know. And this NRC period, which is a domestic competition that falls either side of Super Rugby, is a great opportunity for us to start doing more of that, I think, over the coming months.
Yeah. So that's you're actually still in well, probably NRC preseason right now, right?
That's right. So we probably just started that over the last 2 weeks.
Okay.
And in the past, we've probably run our NRC program quite separate to our Super Rugby program. But I know you've spoken a bit to Ben Darwin. If you believe any of Ben Darwin's theories, I guess he really talks about the combination of players playing together, and the more they play together, the more successful a team becomes, essentially. And a lot of other teams during Super Rugby teams during the NRC period split their teams. So say, for example, New South Wales, they have two teams. So when they go into the NRC period, the Waratahs are split into two teams, as are the Reds. And for us, we actually get the opportunity potentially to play our team through for another sort of 8 games if we make the finals together. And that's just another half of Super Rugby season, you know. So we've really treated this NRC period as a continuation of the work we're doing, and I guess ultimately where we want to get to, you know. And as I say, you know, we feel pleased with our progress, but we know we've got a huge amount of work still to do.
Yeah, and that's got to add an extra challenge in terms of player management, knowing that you've really got a season and a half on your hands rather than one season.
Yeah, I think so. But some of the stuff we did around our conditioning, you know, we built an athletic base, but we need to keep improving on that. You know, I think if I think of the Kiwi teams, I think they're different in really three key areas. The one is athletically. I think in the past, what's happened in Australia is a player would normally, or top end player, will be part of a Super Rugby program for sort of 6 months of the year, and then the second 6 months they'll be part of the Wallaby program, and there was not as much collaboration between those two programs as there should have been, and that's changing through the work that Checker and his staff are doing now, which is great. But if you think of how different that is to the New Zealand program, where there's a single guy who oversees all of the athletic development across all of the programs in New Zealand, all the teams. So there's a sort of a single view of that player, you can just see by looking at their players what a difference that's made to the ability to play at speed and for longer. I think the other area where New Zealand are ahead of us at the moment is in the contact area.
A lot of people
talk about their skill, but their skill is really the result of them being dominant in the contact area, the ability to produce quick ball and attack sort of disconnected defenses, I guess, is their real strength. And then I think the last thing is their ability to actually create environments that are very much player-led, coach-supported, you know. I look at a team like the Chiefs, and they're obviously a great team, but if you look at the individuals in that team, you know, yes, they have some world-class players, but all teams have world-class players, but I think that they produce ahead of themselves as a team because of the environment that Dave Rennie as the coach has created for them there, you know. It's very much player-led, and I think the players take a lot of ownership for the outcomes, and obviously have been very successful with that approach.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, just going back on the strength in the contact part of the game, you often hear people comment on how good the Kiwi teams are at offloading, and that, you know, all teams should offload more. And it's like, well, if you don't get in behind the defense, you can't offload effectively. So you have to dominate that contact. And I think any of those Kiwi super teams are just exceptional at that part of the game for sure.
Yeah, I mean, our feeling there, Andy, is that quick ball is much more highly correlated to line breaks than gain line is. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people talk about gain line percentage, but there's times that you'll see the Hurricanes are prepared to go backwards just to split the field. So they'll play off the edge. They want to get to the middle of the field almost, they're prepared to go backwards, but they're going to generate very quick ball from that breakdown, and then they can attack you on both sides. And I think that's quite a mindset shift from the way some of us have thought about rugby, which is just about, you know, dashing and getting into the game line. In actual fact, it's really about how many defenders can I tie up and how quickly can I reproduce the ball to be able to attack the space that's created, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, you touched on earlier on the show that, you know, there was a lot of off-field distractions with the ARU proposing the drop from 5 to 4 teams. Yeah, for me, that's been pretty well covered and well publicized in the media and podcasts. So, you know, those kind of the decision-making parts of that I don't really want to go into, but I'm really interested in how you and your fellow coaches and the players attack that. And, you know, just from an outsider looking in, it looked like, and from listening to what you're saying, it unified the group. It actually became a strength, not a weakness. And that's all got to come from you and the coaching staff to lead the playing group to think like that. What were some of the strategies you put in place?
Well, there's an old saying, I guess, Andy, never waste a crisis. Excuse me. There's probably three things that we try to do intentionally. One was the idea of a rewards, what we call our rewards culture, which basically is just this idea that our emotions are contagious. Mm-hmm. And I guess it comes back to the idea that, you know, we get to control actually the environment that we come to work in every day. Mm-hmm. You know, we want a place that's energized and that people enjoy coming to. You know, we want people to come to the Western Force and never want to leave, you know. And so what we would do in our rewards culture, for example, is we only celebrate the good things. Mm. So in a team meeting, I would very, very rarely point out something that somebody's done wrong. Mm-hmm. What we would do is we would, I mean, say, for example, on a very basic level, who are the top, I don't know, whatever statistic, who are the top 10 tacklers in the team? So we'll produce a list of the top 10, but we'll never produce the bottom 30. Mm-hmm. And we'll never tell you who's last. Now, of course, the players know we know that. But what it effectively does is it makes those people feel really good. And human nature is that you want to be praised, you know. So when those names go up in the team, human nature is that I think people say, yeah, you know, that's pretty cool. We give them a round of applause, we probably make some jokes about them, whatever. But you can be assured that if you're competing for the center spot and you see the other center up on that list and your name's not up there, the message to you is pretty clear, and all the time we've managed to do that in a pretty positive way. You know?
Yeah, oh, that's great.
That doesn't mean that individually I'm not going to be tapping a guy on the shoulder and say, look, you know, this needs to be done better or whatever. That doesn't mean that. It means as a group, collectively, we really try to focus on the positives and we try to mm-hmm. focus on the wins mm-hmm. that we're getting. And I think that starts to create almost a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It's great, yeah. And you mentioned also you know, intensity and being intentional, and also hope. How'd those play into the process?
Yeah, I think intensity is probably it's something that you sort of intuitively know as a coach, but I've only started to call it that to the players in the last couple of weeks, which is just you know, how do we attack our work every day? Part of that is about being intentional. So for a coach, for what that means for me is that we have very few team meetings, for example. When we first started out, we have a young guy who plays in the Australian under-20s, Sham Beklavu, and I saw him doing the wildebeest to the back of the room, you know, he's sort of nodding off and he's trying to stay awake with all his might, but about 15 minutes into the meeting, he's bored to tears, you know?
Yeah.
So what we ended up doing is we actually run a process now in the morning where the coaches take all of our laptops and we just sit in a common area where the players are having their breakfast and screening and doing those things where they can come over and just talk to us. And we would have cut footage from yesterday's training session or you know, we might have a new play that we want to run this weekend, so we'd have that prepared on the laptops for them. And the guy will come over and, you know, he'll ask me about that and we'll have a conversation. And we found that works much better than me standing up like the headmaster at the front of the room giving a lecture. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's great.
And we've actually found that the richness of those conversations have been much more rewarding. There's much more thought now going into the players about, okay, well, why are we running this play? And they can ask questions about it all, you know. Maybe we could try this option on it. And that it's really the richness of that debate that I think has had some value to us. So being intentional is about, you know, what are the real specific things as a coach that we want to achieve today? And we go down to the session and the way we sort of describe it to each other as a coaching staff is that if one of us didn't know what the objectives of of you were for the coaching session, they should at the end of the session be able to tell me these were the three things that you were trying to get out of that. And if you've run a good session and you've constructed it in the right way, it should be pretty obvious to everybody. This is what we're trying to achieve in this session. And we would focus generally on only three things in any one training session. So I always sort of joke with the guys, you know, it's very easy to think of things in groups of three: three blind mice, Tom, Dick, and Harry, the Holy Trinity, Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It's quite hard to think of something in four. So three sort of like the limit that people can remember and retain. So we try to keep our objectives down to three simple things. And then we try to encourage ourselves as coaches to be intentional in that work. So they should be able to analyze their session and look at the intensity of their coaching. For example, did their body language and their voice match what they were trying to coach? Did they treat all the players the same? Were they engaged in the activity, or did they stand outside of the activity? All of these sort of questions is the sort of stuff as a coach when we talk about intensity or being intentional. We've got to do those things better every single day. You know, we've got to actually be prepared to analyze our own coaching, I guess, in the way that we expect the players to analyze their playing. You know,
For sure. That's role modeling, right? They're going to feed off you there. If you're excited and into the session, you know, there's not much chance that they're not going to be either. If you're showing how passionate you are.
Yeah, and I think you know it's very easy when you look at a piece of play or whatever as a coach to sort of say, gee, there's 10 things that are wrong there. You know, you're not going to fix those things today. Mm-hmm. And so it's a real discipline to say, look, there's a real structured approach to what we're trying to achieve here. This is how I plan to sort of sell it. This is the progression of that work. And then the step that a lot of coaches I think miss is to actually go back to their work afterwards and put their headphones on and watch themselves coaching it and say, you know, I did all of this pre-planning, but am I able to be iterative in my development? Am I able to actually say, you know, I didn't quite nail that, or, you know, in that drill, you know, I should have done X, Y, Z. And you only see that through actually analyzing it afterwards. And I think that's a step that a lot of coaches miss.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, well, last question before we go to our final four questions. You earned your trade as a defense coach originally. Is that still your favorite area of the game to coach? And, you know, how's that look in practice? And if someone was to come and watch a session run by you, what are some of the things they're going to see and hear?
It probably is the easiest part of the game to coach. You know? I think the really good coaches probably coach attack, because that's probably the most dynamic part of the game. You know, and defense is very system. Certainly, the way I run a defense is probably pretty system orientated, and it's just about a lot of energy and. You know, everybody understands the rules. It's just about executing the rules of the system with intensity, and you get some pretty good outcomes. You know, so it certainly is the easiest part of the game to coach. And I think, again, you know, having never been a player, I think it was always going to be an uphill. I guess I can't remember, consciously or subconsciously, sort of realized that defense was going to be the easiest route to actually to sort of go anywhere with my coaching, because I think a lot of other coaches want to coach attack and kind of the more sexy parts of the game, you know. So that's probably really how I started. But I guess as you get more into it, you sort of get absorbed by it, you know, and actually you really enjoy that part of the game. And there's no doubt, you know, you watch the Hurricanes Brumbies game on the weekend in the quarterfinal, and everybody talks about what a fantastic attacking side the Hurricanes are. Well, you know, they won that game on their defense, yeah, you know, which was just unbelievable. Brumbies just couldn't get out of their 22. And so it's still true that the best teams are, or at least that defense wins championships, you know. So it's a big part of the game and something that I definitely do enjoy coaching.
All right, great. Okay, well, we always end the show with the same final four questions. When you were a kid growing up in South Africa, who was one of your favorite players to watch that really drew you to the game of rugby?
Was a flanker for the Free State called Andre Venter.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
For the Cheetahs, played a lot of games for the Springboks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think why I liked him is probably just because I don't think he was probably the most talented guy on the field. But he just had an enormous work rate. And I heard a lot of stories about him that just how hard he used to work off field. You know, there were some stories that after training he'd throw his bag on the team bus and sort of run back to the team hotel. So I'm not sure how true those things are, but certainly when you saw him play, you know, he was just tough, and he just got through a huge amount of work without particularly, you know, carrying the ball particularly much or doing any of the sort of the sexier stuff, you know. And I always enjoyed playing him. I certainly would have not liked to have played against him, that's for sure.
Cool. And what about now? Who are some of the players going around that you like watching what they do?
Oh, I mean, I'd have to name everybody in my team, I guess, in case someone's listening.
Sure. Yeah.
But I think probably one of the best players in the world right now would have to be Owen Farrell. I think he's a pretty special talent, you know, and he'll be a big part of that England team. I think they've got some exciting times ahead because there's a couple of young players there that are absolutely world class, you know. So it's going to be interesting to see how they go over the next couple of years.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to watch for sure. And what about coaches? Who's a high profile coach that you like the way they go about their business?
Oh, there's a lot, Andy, I guess, and I've been very lucky in the coaches that have taken the time to sort of help me in my career, and you know, I'm very grateful for all of them. I think the guy that I probably most admire from the outside, and although I don't know him very well, played against him a few times, but is as I said, Dave Rennie at the Chiefs.
Okay, yeah.
Just because I hear odd whispers about how they run their environment, and I certainly, as I say, when you look at their team on paper. And I mean this as a compliment, I think they probably achieved ahead of themselves because they are such a good team, you know, and that's obviously in a huge way down to the way Dave Rennie runs things over there. So it's going to be interesting to see how he goes in Europe and whether he can recreate that culture in a different environment.
Yeah, his name comes up quite often, and yeah, I'm fascinated about how that's going to roll out as well. Yeah, it's exciting stuff. And what about you know, a coach who doesn't have Dave Rennie's profile that's just doing good work in behind the scenes?
Oh, I think someone in our environment who deserves a lot of credit is Sean Byrne, who's our attack coach. This is Sean's first year of senior coaching. He coached the Leinster Academy previously. I mean, he played a lot of games as a player. I think over 200 first class games. At places like Leinster and Bath, and obviously the Waratahs.
Mm-hmm.
So he's still learning as a coach in terms of getting better, you know, at his trade, as we all are. But I think he understands the game very well. He's got a great mind for rugby, and he's also incredibly dedicated. You know, he's one of those coaches who, you know, watch the video until the tape sort of fades out. You know what I mean? Mm. And those guys are worth gold. You know, he's sort of seeing something at the bottom of a ruck on a sixth phase that nobody else even sort of bothered to look at, you know. And I think it's that sort of detail that's ultimately going to make him a very good coach.
Oh, that's great. And definitely someone to keep an eye on, someone you definitely want to keep your hands on in terms of the Force for future seasons.
Yeah, definitely.
No doubt. Yeah. Awesome. Well, I just want to say thank you for giving up your time. I know you're really busy with Super Rugby winding down and NRC picking up again. So just wanted to say thanks for coming onto the show. And again, really enjoyed the way that the Force went at it this year. And can't wait to see what the future holds for them. And hopefully the decision's a good one in terms of keeping the Force going, because I think it'll be a travesty of justice if it wasn't the case. So. You know, thanks again, David, for coming on the show.
Thanks, Andy. Appreciate it.
No worries. All right, cheers.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks for listening to the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review via iTunes and keep listening for the next episode. You can also follow us on Twitter at RugbyCoachSCNR. Or via the website at therugbycoachescorner.com. Until next time, keep sharing ideas to make the game better.